You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero o The Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of The Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Kia ora tātou. My name is Amy Wing, and I'm the curator at The Physics Room, and this is episode 48 of Art Not Science. In this episode, we'll be sharing an artist talk with Te Whanganui o Tata-based artist and curator, Daniel John Corbett Sanders. Daniel is interested in critical geographies and social power structures, especially the relationship between LGBTQIA+ people and political economies. His work is fantastical and often references film techniques by playing with storyboarding, vignettes, and narrative. Daniel's work was included in our recent exhibition Back Dirt, alongside Ōtautahi-based artist Priscilla Rose Howe. Back dirt is the dirt that is put to one side in the process of an archaeological dig. It might be refiltered later for fragments, or simply returned to fill the hole. Another reading is in relation to the human body and residual matter that may accumulate out of sight. The exhibition Back Dirt draws on both these sets of associations, proposing we look again at that which is often put aside, or less visible in mainstream representations of queerness. The figurative works by Priscilla and Daniel register a spectrum of states: joy, excess, discomfort, pain, sadness, and anger. In doing so, they set out to expand the room for public expressions of queerness beyond what is marketable and tidy into a space of powerful, ordinary multiplicity. Now, let's listen to the talk.
Kia ora, Dan.
Welcome to the Physics Room podcast. Quite an interesting situation where we're having an artist talk, which is actually the exhibition, the project itself is closed. So we're sort of looking back on it reflexively, I guess. For me, there's something quite luxurious and quite interesting about that, but let's launch in and see how it goes. Just to start off with, are you happy to introduce yourself as you would like to?
Yeah, absolutely. Kia ora, Abby. Thanks for having me. My name is Dan and I'm an artist and I also work in galleries. Currently as the director of Enjoy Gallery in Wellington. And I have a practice that kind of looks at the redistribution of care and political value through curatorial practice and also through artistic practice.
Did you want to say anything? I know a lot as we were developing the exhibition, there were many references probably to our respective childhoods, but since you're the star of the show, do you want to maybe just reflect a bit on your background, where you grew up? I know some of these things ended up feeding into what the show became.
For sure. So I grew up in New Plymouth and around Taranaki and a few different places in Mōkō and in Uruanui, which are small kind of country towns. I'm from a large family. I have five siblings. A lot of the families that lived in these places were also similar kind of family situations. There was a lot of kind of poverty, like mixed race families, all sorts of things going on, which led to a really interesting situation to grow up in. I have brothers who were in gangs and all sorts of things like that. So I guess growing up in this situation, I was exposed to what for some people would be quite unusual situations. And then when I eventually moved to Auckland to study, to go to university, to art school, I noticed that I wasn't really coming across people who came from a similar background or had shared similar experiences, especially as a queer person. There was quite a lot of people from, I guess, middle class, upper middle class kind of backgrounds who had, in my point of view, quite sheltered lives or had access to understandings of queerness that I hadn't had in New Plymouth, such as growing up around Karangahape Road in Auckland, knowing what a drag queen was, and just having like a very basic vocabulary already as a young person, which is something that didn't exist in the situation I grew up in.
Thanks for sharing that, Dan. I guess, yeah, I think you've said in the past that a lot of your artwork does in some way reflect that experience of moving from a small town, having this kind of rural or, yeah, not urban center experience, and then moving to a big city. And in some way, cliche as it sounds, I think we're all doing this, like trying to find oneself. And the experiences of failure, I guess, as well as consolidation of that identity. Just while we're in this sort of childhood space, I think particularly in this work that you showed here, arguably throughout earlier projects as well, the idea of like a New Zealand Gothic is being in the foreground or the background or somewhere in the picture. Can you speak to that sort of relationship and history in your work? How does that sit for you?
Just from the way I grew up or whatever, I just became really interested in what stories weren't being told and why weren't they being told. There was a kind of darkness to it, I guess, like a lot of the stories. New Zealand, from the position that I grew up in, is quite a poor country. It's quite a harsh country. And I feel like there is this kind of sensibility, aesthetic sensibility, and it's in our humor and the way we talk to each other as well, that we've developed. It's quite humorous, really dark, brutal humor or something. But yeah, I think for me, looking at the, using that kind of childlike style of drawing that I used in my work, so kind of like returning to revisiting the child or something, was a way to, I don't know, I think thinking of the stories that are told and the ones that aren't told and the histories that get missed because of that, I think looking at the childhood stuff is quite interesting because it's almost like a nostalgia or something, and nostalgia is this way that we share this kind of collective memory of the past, or like what our understanding of a place might be, like New Zealand as a country or a Pākehā culture or something like that. Yeah, and I'm quite interested in challenging that, I guess, or reimagining, breaking the kind of nostalgic value of that maybe, aesthetically.
I can see that kind of, that kind of like warm, rosy glow or something that you might associate, or a sentimentality with nostalgia, thinking about what that erases or what is submerged within that maybe. I certainly got from your work, even though in many ways it is, well, there's a sort of tension between the content being quite confronting and then style being, I don't know, to me it often felt quite tender. And I wondered if in some ways you're looking back at some things that happened in your childhood, be they quite, you know, like tough things to experience, but also wanting to, I don't know, hold those things gently or kind of not whitewash them or pinkwash them or do something that kind of sanitizes them. Does that resonate with you? Like that word tenderness? I don't know if that's getting a bit sticky.
I mean, tenderness and things like that isn't something that I would say I do consciously, but it's good that comes out.
So this relates to your use of figurative imagery, I guess, like in quite a explicit kind of literal way. I think you said it's on multiple occasions to me, it's really important that people that you work with, people that you live your life with, can quite literally see themselves in the work. I'm just going to read this tiny thing that you wrote to me. The people I depict are often somewhere between the ideal image of queerness and the grim or maybe grimy reality of queerness. They're somewhere in the shadows. They're not at the pride party. They're trying to get home safely across a sprawling city at 5 a.m. with only $5 to their name. Not having sex at the sauna, they're trying to use the free computer to find your strange dad on Facebook. Or they're in a provincial town locked into domestic politics where all possibility of their queer belonging has been denied by the myth of queerness belonging to the big city party goer. I know you wrote that to me a while ago. Does that resonate with you still? I'm just trying to think of like this experience.
100%. I think because I worked at a cruise club in Auckland for 5 years, and cruise clubs and that kind of cruise culture, I guess, there's a bit of like queer theory around it, written in this quite positive light. exploring the kind of, I guess, utopian aspects of it against a heterosexual society. But the reality of working there was quite different, thinking that cruise clubs often emerge pre-HIV, so there was a little bit more of this liberal kind of thing. And then after HIV and AIDS like decimated the community, the role of those spaces changed too. So working in these cruise clubs, it was often people from out of town who didn't have a space to go in the city in the same way that people go to like a library or something. It was just a space to be while being in town. It was a space to, check your Facebook, email, use drugs without being under security, without the police being called on you. You could indulge in your sexuality there if you wanted to, but often it was more of just this like social space and safe space for people, kind of how Diane Chisholm talks about it in her book Queer Constellations. Like there's just like multiple, I guess, constellations, multiple different ways that space is interpreted that often queer theory doesn't accurately reflect. So yeah, that definitely sticks with me. And then I would notice working there that there were particular people, or not people, there were particular narratives that were being told in the art industry that, from queer artists, that didn't really represent what I was actually seeing.
What do you mean there?
And so I wanted to tell that story, like the stories of that I was actually witnessing. So in that way, I kind of look at my work as some weird roundabout ways being kind of documentary style, even though it's really not, obviously. But yeah.
I like how you say that. I mean, it's a record, and a record is a, you know, it's a document, albeit that highly sort of stylized one. I think you talked about this idea of like the history of the queer. And I mean, if we think about the material form of your work, a whole lot of broken shards of plasterboard, the idea of it being like a broken gay club or a broken sort of artifact of queer history in some way, again, being quite literal. But yeah, does that symbolism kind of work for you?
Definitely. Yeah, like when I worked at the cruise club, and I've worked in other ways in the kind of sex industry before as well, and I was really interested in the kind of visuals and architectures of those spaces. And there's some really interesting things around that. I think it was Diane Chisholm who wrote about it too, about how in America, some of the spaces would be designed to raise darker skin bodies through their lighting and things. And yeah, so there's this kind of like all these dark sides of those cruise clubs. The one I worked at had all these like images of army men and lots of like barbed wire and camouflage kind of materials, like military materials. There were posters of like really muscular bodybuilders everywhere, and condom ads with people holding things like guns and spears and things, saying like gear up, and like it was almost like a call to war or something. And it was then mirrored, the kind of people that I talked to there would often be quite extremely misogynistic, extremely anti-Semitic, extremely racist in different types of ways. Yeah, and so I was kind of interested in how this kind of idea of a cruise club and this kind of like, what is the point of a queer space? If this is a queer space, what's the point if it's just fostering this kind of like extreme toxic shit? And maybe it should just be destroyed. I guess also metaphorically or something, there's all these different narratives in my work. Each kind of shard has a different thing going on. And I think that was another element, was the impossibility of there being kind of one singular space or narrative or whatever, like it's just impossible. And it is just about arranging these fragmented things in different ways to try and create some kind of meaning.
Like a sorting and a resorting. Like I think there's definitely an archaeological reference there as well, with the idea of things that might be piled up from a dig.
Yeah. And then there's also, on that note of archaeological stuff, like showing alongside like Priscilla, there was lots of thinking around, the history of actual cruise clubs and them originating from saunas, and saunas having wall paintings that would have like these kind of utopic sexual imagery on the wall. and how that changed. I guess Priscilla kind of spoke to that more element. And then my work was like, well, what if we break it, or what's the negative side of that?
Yeah. It's a good way of sort of reducing the work to its bones, or the project to its bones, the conversation between those two works.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
I think just one other thing that you've mentioned was the kind of accessibility point of the work, and like how important it is for people that I know to see themselves in it. I think that's quite important for me because I did have a show straight out of art school. It was quite minimalist, and someone that was in one of the works came and saw it, and they were just like so isolated by the work. And they were quite a camp person, and they just said to me, darling, no one cares about this. They just want to see big, colorful things with glitter on it. And it was so true. And it was like the best criticism I've ever had. And this was coming from someone who lived like, it took them like 2 hours to get into town. They didn't have much money. Like, it was like a huge thing for them to go to an art gallery. They'd never been there before. So thinking about that, like if someone's going to make such an effort to go and see a show that's supposedly speaking to them, should make it worth their while.
I feel you. Like, I think there's a real idea of like, sometimes when we talk about audience and who's the work for, it's like somebody incredibly distant from us. But actually a lot of the audiences, I think, that are most important, certainly to me, is like someone who supports the development of these projects. They're so close that they're not, you don't identify them as an audience. It's actually like a intimately kind of connected community. And if you can't be generous to those people, then what are you doing?
Yeah, 100%.
I wonder if we talk a bit more about the, I guess, like the form of the work in this space. Not everyone listening to this will have seen it. Loosely speaking, comprised a pile of shards of plasterboard onto which you'd painted, I guess, like figurative scenes or records, drawings of incidents that you'd been part of or witnessed. Talk to me about your choice of plasterboard and then the watercolor or the paints that you used.
Yeah, the plasterboard, I really wanted to do what I've been wanting for a long time to do, looking at the history of wall painting and kind of queer painting's relationship to it, things like frescoes and stuff in old bathhouses. Kind of wanted to do that, but this made more sense to do that but break it. It's a bit of like an anti-art moment too, I guess. So that was kind of the thinking around that. It was a bit of like a rebellion thing going on. There was a bit of a more conceptual thing about like this cruise club and everything it represents is now destroyed, and what's left and what do we make of it. And I think generally too around, a lot of queer theory stuff that I've read, that seems to be the space we're in. It's like, cool, what now or something? I don't know. Anyway.
Well, a deconstruction maybe to be like, okay, hang on, what are the components that I want to hold on to? Indeed, we can have any kind of hopeful future.
As I went, I really enjoyed the combination of different shards. Each shard did have a different kind of scene, I guess, on it, or different spoke to a different thing. And when they were sat next to each other or on top of each other or whatever, they kind of created new meanings when you started reading different images against each other, next to each other. I liked how it would be impossible to kind of have something fixed, and it was always going to shift in that way as well. And in terms of the watercolor, that was actually something that you suggested that I do, which was really great. Yeah, the watercolors kind of speak to a history of wall painting too, like old, like, you know, cave paintings. Their original stuff was all done by mixing pigment of some kind with water, maybe some kind of binding agent eventually, and this kind of pictographic form, which is also something that I was kind of doing, riffing on like a child drawing all over the walls or something. Yeah, so I kind of liked the idea of using, I guess, forms that speak to an art history but kind of breaking the rules of how they're used a little bit, materials and forms.
No, I think so. Talking about that relationship, yeah, I think it can seem like a bit of an obvious one, but I love the idea that you were painting with something that brought with it a particular history, and then this kind of moment of like shitty construction materials was colliding with that, with a history of like very meticulous form and world building that might be associated with watercolor.
I'm quite interested in biopolitics and kind of the like who has the right to live in society in a very broad term, and all the politics around that, who's deciding that. Yeah, there's this book called Homo Sacer by Giorgio Agamben or something, who talks about the Homo Sacer, which is this idea that someone is outside of the law and also beneath the law, and it's someone whose life means nothing. So this kind of person, their life is just rendered below life itself, almost like they're just rendered bare life. So kill them and nothing would happen to you, because it was like you weren't even killing a human, you're just killing an object pretty much. And this was a really useful kind of concept or something back in ancient Rome. This is when this kind of concept came about, but in the establishment of the sovereign or sovereignty, and that is useful for the establishment of sovereignty because it's gives, yeah, because the sovereign is someone who has the capacity to kill and is also can kill without committing homicide. Yeah, it serves as like this homo sacer or this bare life kind of things, therefore like as an instrument within the establishment of sovereignty, because they can be taken out of the system or out of society by being killed without repercussion. And that's kind of how sovereignty is established and maintained.
In relation to this work, are you thinking about the queer subject as being the is not having sovereignty in this kind of history?
Well, yeah, so that's where I get kind of interested, because a lot of queer politics and discourse is around kind of a pursuit for equity or pursuit for sovereignty or to participate in a sovereign system. So like in a New Zealand context, the sovereign system, aka the dominant power, is this colonial government that we've been fighting to have an equal like stake in, which is quite interesting, because what I'm interested in, like what the consequences or the effects of that might be, like because we're telling some stories, are we rendering others invisible or kind of creating, yeah, like at what cost does that come, I guess. And I think that kind of connects up to this other element that I'm quite interested in, which is around this idea of homo nationalism, which is a term that Jazz Papois kind of coined in her book Terrorist Assemblages. Going back to the homo sacer thing, I definitely think historically queer people were rendered like bare life or below being considered worthy of living or participating in society, and in still today in several ways they're still treated that way. But recently we've seen like more of an acceptance or tolerance of queer people, especially when there happens to be some kind of financial, political or social benefit for a business or institution, government, or even an individual. But often that has nothing to do with the actual broader health and well-being of queer people. So in that sense, queer people just become a kind of tool in this establishment of sovereign power or something, which Jazz Papois talks about a lot in relation to like the formation of the Israeli state, for example. Yeah, the representation or treatment of LGBT people is kind of used as a measure of a successful nation or a nation that is up to Western standards and therefore worthy of defense. But yeah, in that process, nations or cultures that might have a different relationship to representation and treatment of queer people end up being othered and then often folded into this kind of sovereign establishment of human versus inhuman, which can lead to other issues such as justifying Islamophobia in defense of LGBT citizens. In the context of New Zealand, I'm quite interested in how we generally have like an absence of a comprehensive recorded queer history and theories as well. So we often like adopt ones from America or Europe. And so I'm interested in how that contributes to this kind of colonial erasure of our violent, more violent history and the effects of that, of colonization essentially, that still affect people and the kind of the lived experiences that still are ongoing today. So like LGBT rights in that way can kind of act as a sort of pinkwashing over top of colonial accountability.
So the queer histories, if any get told, the ones that do are very, let's just say like rainbow-hued kind of very positive.
Yeah.
Laboratory histories of identity along really particular lines that are legible to the sort of dominant structure or something.
This conversation's been had a lot, especially in this country, around like Māori rights and representation and things, especially when thinking about redressing the past and how when kind of colonial narratives or like narratives coming from the dominant society or the sovereign are challenged, it just ends up with the silence and no one talks about anything and then when Māori do challenge that silence, then they just get often shut down or met with extreme racism and stuff. Mm. Similar kind of thing happens with queer people, but also queer people can end up sometimes without knowing being very complicit in that system. And I'm kind of interested in how that happens, and especially in our visual culture too, how our visual culture might contribute to that happening.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
I just think if we just broaden things out a bit, I'm thinking of you. I know you've worked in the past, you're the founder of Parasite, the space that ran in Tāmaki Makaurau for, was it a couple of years?
Yeah, 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, so you've worked as a you've worked in a different side of things as well in terms of artistic production. And I guess I was interested in how that experience was for you, knowing as well that at the minute, as you mentioned at the beginning, you're working as the director, curatorial role at Enjoy. Yeah, how is that? How do you see that kind of, is that just something you approach quite fluidly, the movement between identifying as an artist and then some other kind of facilitation role? Or do they feel like quite different headspaces and spaces of work for you?
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. I actually find like the identification as this or that, like to be kind of cringe in some ways. Like,
as soon as I said that, I was going to be trouble.
But I also am very conscious that I feel in this country, and I've been held up by different people too, saying they have to pick one or the other. People do struggle with the idea that you can do many things. I guess we've got limited space or something. So people, yeah, whatever. I find there's a kind of, they slip between each other quite easily. Obviously, materiality is very different, but I'm frustrated with the same things when I'm working in a gallery than when I'm making an artwork. So the kind of concerns around stuff around funding and money and representation and visibility and all the fallouts around that within from a Creative New Zealand level right down to like a community level. Yeah, I'm always thinking about that and kind of trying to address that in different ways through the projects that I do. And know that I can always do more and more and more. There's a lot of work to be done in that area. And it's tricky too, because we're all fighting for the same things really. And there's only a limited amount of stuff. So that's where I think it's really important to get really nuanced about this stuff.
And also not by the site of the gallery as kind of a beginning and an end of meaning production or conversation or something. Like, I think something that I loved about the closing of this show was your and Priscilla's suggestion that we throw like a queer club night and invite people, well, as much as invite people, be occupy a different space and hopefully bring our communities and some sense of that being an expanded kind of site, not for the project, but for people who live these queer lives doing their shit, just a night for dancing and for coming and spending time together in a space. And as much as anything else, I think for me, that was a really important part of the show. It didn't we closed the doors of the gallery. It didn't really have anything to do with the gallery site at that point, but it still existed as, you know, an act that was like, we admitted that like meaning wasn't just happening inside the gallery. You didn't have to go and see something and have some sort of like transaction of knowledge or experience or something like that. It was just a thing that happened. So I loved, I love that gesture. I really appreciate that you guys put that forward. And I know, I think it will be remembered by the community here as well. So that's quite a cool, form of an art historical legacy in a way, or some kind of something that's held kind of collectively.
Yeah, that's really great. It looked incredible. And I definitely agree that, yeah, it's like not, is like you say, not allowing the gallery to become the be-all and end-all of these kind of conversations, that things do have a lifetime and maybe more importantly outside of the gallery. And speaking to the party night, but also to like the drawings and stuff, I think just having fun is a huge thing. Like kind of a background, I guess, to this whole project was that I proposed something very different, and we had a conversation saying over like a few months, going backwards and forwards, and it got to the point where I think I emailed you and said, I'm bored by this, my own proposal. Like, I think this is just boring, and can I just do some fun stuff? Thinking that you'd probably just shut down the proposal and be like, nah, that's, you know, you said you'd do this. So it was really great to work with you and enabling me to kind of do that. And I think that's really important for queer people as well as people in general, is to make sure that they're not sacrificing or not letting their own politics or like their head get in the way of their own, just like having fun and finding joy in what you're doing. I feel like a lot of queer people, as well as other people, have to justify themselves in order to participate in these spaces, which often comes across in a proposal system. People just being like, I want to do really random drawings of like my nana in a coffin driving around a golf course. It's like more like, oh, there's this big broad concept thing or whatever. So I think it's important to break that. And also, yeah, going back to like blurring that with working in galleries or something, that's definitely an approach that I think is really important for those spaces too. They should be fun. Everyone should be, well, you know, and even if it's like very serious content, there should be a willingness or like a fun approach to it or something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I do agree. Like, I think in the same space or project or something like that, there can be power, there can be a space for quite, I don't know, deep or complicated or painful work or memories, and at the same time for quite a joy. Like, I think that was something quite significant in the collaboration or the pairing of your work with Priscilla's, is really her big, colourful, figurative wall drawing of a number of people in a spa pool kind of feasting or having some kind of celebration. It really drew a lot of people in with, I don't know, smiling and just, yeah, there was a real space of, if not ecstasy, I think there was like notes of euphoria, or people had memories that related to situations like that. And I do think there's a politics of that can get quite overlooked in our serious like justification of existence at a very kind of like basic level, well, not basic, at a primary, most significant level. And then the kind of layering of, I don't know, was like discourse and theory and a lot of conversations that are brain conversations. They're not always about bodies and guts and hearts, which is such a big part of everyone's experience, you know. Did you want to make any closing comments? Did you want to like talk about work or upcoming program and joy? I guess, yeah, just acknowledging that we have moved on from the time that dirt was in the gallery, but also I guess I'm just like very interested in kind of queer programming, what that looks like, what kinds of conversations might have extended in your head from work like the ones you showed in Back Dirt into the space you're working at now.
So now I'm working on a couple of things. I've always seen my drawing, painting things as being like, what are they called? Storyboards. They're kind of like sketches for moving image, which is always the thing that I start off wanting to do, but just don't actually have the proper skill set to do it. So it ends up in this kind of like the storyboard form or whatever. So I think that's important to note too, that I see my work functioning more like that as opposed to participating so directly in like a discourse of painting history or whatever. Yeah, so I'm working on some moving image stuff properly at the moment, which is super exciting. Taking some of the paintings that I've done over the years into that form. And then, yeah, working at Enjoy, just kind of, I guess, similar thing, maybe not explicitly around queer stuff, though that's definitely a part of it. There was actually this quote on this book that I've been reading. It's this one. This, I think, just came out, Aftermaths. And it says, what we choose to remember and what we choose to forget about the violent past tell us something about the society we live in now. Whether we like it or not, we're part of each other's story. So how do we talk about the past? Which is by Joanna Kidman and Vincent O'Malley in their essay at the start of the book. But I guess that summed up nicely my thinking is just all the projects we're working on coming up. Like we're working with Bonnie Tarmati from Samoa House Library on a project with five artists in it, opening on the 7th of July, which speaks to different histories of like and experiences of the Pacific diaspora, but in particular, people speaking to histories often that are quite difficult histories that aren't told, and approaching it with, I guess, joy or finding these accessible points into those stories. And I'm finding that really exciting, and I don't have any answers. I'm just trying to learn. But how do you retell these histories or stories that are lost or not being told without, like, yeah, because a lot of them can be really difficult, really grimy, and really upsetting to a lot of people. So how do you navigate that space? I'm finding really interesting.
Yeah. How do you, like, acknowledge the existence of something that's difficult and not be kind of paralyzed by the difficulty?
Because, yeah, you do want people to come in and get it and, like, walk away having some kind of taken something away with them. Yeah, so that's what we're kind of working on at the moment in different ways. There's not just with LGBT histories and art histories, but, like, generally across the board, there's so much work to be done. And, yeah, like I say at the start, I'm quite interested in how queer politics and this fight for representation or like whatever can end up being complicit in potentially silencing or removing other histories. So, and with that, bodies and people. So, yeah.
Oh, thanks, Dan. I guess it is some time ago now, but I really do want to acknowledge the, it meant a lot to me as well, working on that project. I really enjoyed the dialogue we had over quite a long time, and even though a few exhibition proposals got chucked in the trash along the way, I think there was kind of that's some healthy compost for to reflect on as well. But it's not so often that you get to work on a project where you're I felt like I was testing a lot of things too, and you definitely pushed some boundaries with me that I found really productive. Some of the content was really confronting for me, and I had to really process like what that was about and how to be sort of like kaitiaki in a way that I felt I could be strong in, like for work that was, you know, to care for your work and then to care for people coming in who are like me and like, what's that? What's that about? And maybe that does relate to a difficult history that they've got. Being able to, I guess just like for me, learning to navigate and kind of articulate that more to myself was very, it was definitely like a growing thing. So really, I really appreciate that. I really love your practice, and I'm quite excited to see, you know, as it moves across curatorial and artistic work, I'm really excited to see what's next for you as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been great to work with you too.
That was Daniel John Corbett Sanders talking about his practice and recent exhibition Back Dirt with Priscilla Rose Howe at the Physics Room. By the time this episode airs, a new exhibition will have opened. The Air Like a Stone brings together a feature-length 16mm film by London-based filmmaker and painter Rosalind Nashashibi, titled Denim Sky, and a newly commissioned installation by Ototahi-based painter Emma Fitz. Vastly different in many ways, Nashashibi and Fitz's work share a concern with non-nuclear relationships, the social, material, human, and non-linear time. The exhibition is about moments of convergence or community, when something intuitively or collectively experienced becomes momentarily solid and substantial, like a stone. The show runs until the 30th of July, and you can find us on the ground floor at 301 Montreal Street, entrance via Market Square car park. We also have two publications forthcoming. Prepared for release a year subsequent to The Moon in the Pavement's closing as a new winter arrives, The Moon in the Pavement publication brings together documentation images from the exhibition at Ashburton Art Gallery, alongside a narrative text by Chloe Lane. Also included are research images selected by each of the artists, Teresa Collins, Yukari Kaihori, Susu, and Sam Taus, chosen to reflect something that they are currently working on or have been thinking about in the time since the exhibition. This publication will launch in June, so stay tuned for details. In addition, we'll be launching Correspondence Issue 2.2 in July, rounding up the volume. Continuing on from Issue 2.1 and the starting point of a spacious atrium, Correspondence 2.2 reaches a little further, towards the sky and to Aachen. In this issue, you'll find new contributions by Millie Godfrey, Balamohan Shingade, and Nkosi Nkululeko, Lucy Neal, and Ziggy Lever, alongside extracts from Albert Rafiti and Marie Shannon. More details coming soon. Thank you for listening. Tune in next month at Matariki on Friday the 14th of July, 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science. Mā te wā.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.